I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Every single one of us has a hospital story. A long wait, a lost nurse, a screw-up with insurance or registration or medication. It's even worse when you have a friend or a family member in hospital and you're trying to get answers to questions about their diagnosis or their condition, their treatment, or who's supposed to help them get in and out of bed. We mutter about it and complain, but in the end we all agree that, hey, it's the system. You can't fix the system. Dr. Don Berwick would disagree. For the past 20 years, this physician has been looking at the well-being of patients, not by studying slides under a microscope, but by looking at the system through a wide-angle lens. Don Berwick will tell you that patients ought to come first, that whenever you enter a hospital, you should be treated like a guest entering a five-star hotel. Now, is that realistic? He also thinks the current healthcare system needs to be blown up and rebuilt from scratch. What do you think about that? Would it work? What is your prescription for curing the ills of the healthcare system? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour is Don Berwick. He's a pediatrician and a professor at Harvard and head of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and author of a new book called Escape Fire, Designs for the Future of Healthcare. Don, it's nice to have you here in the studio.
Nice to be here, Dick.
Now, you said to someone here at the program that when we talk about these problems, it's not about money. It's always about money, isn't it? I mean, every time we talk to people on this program about healthcare, it's like we need more money for those who don't have insurance. We need more money to run our hospital. We need more money to hire more doctors. You're taking a rather different view.
Well, money's often the beginning of the conversation, but if you look at the facts, it really can't be the problem. In the United States, we're spending 40% more than the next most expensive country on earth on healthcare, and our system's by no means the best one.
So you think there's enough cash in the system?
I think there's more than enough. I think there's, in fact, too much, because there's some evidence that oversupplying healthcare produces a lot of nonsense and some hazard.
So what would you point to as the principal problem? Where do you start with this?
Well, the principal problem is to recognize that we have a defective healthcare system. That's already been done for us by the National Academy of Sciences. The Institute of Medicine of the National Academy a couple of years ago published a landmark piece which really summarized 30 or 40 years of research. We have a system with big defects, and the first thing we need to do is admit that and label what those defects are.
Okay, so, I mean, when we talk about a defect, are you talking about the fact that if I want to get an appointment with my doctor, I might be told by her scheduling assistant that it'll be 6 weeks away? Is that what you're talking about when you're talking about problems?
That's one kind of problem. The Institute of Medicine and other researchers have given us a vocabulary. Actually, there's now a standard vocabulary of six kinds of defect. A little hard for the public to understand, but it might be worth just mentioning them. The first one's safety. We have a relatively unsafe healthcare system. For example, we believe about 40,000 Americans at a minimum are killed each year by their care in hospitals, not by their diseases, but by their care. We create hazards. People get injured and even killed in our system.
By these sorts of deaths, you're talking about deaths from botched operations or maybe even just infections and other things that happen in a hospital.
All of the above, but the secret here is not to view infections, for example, as inevitable. We know how to prevent postoperative infections. We know how to keep people on respirator machines from getting pneumonia. We just don't use that knowledge systematically, and as a result, people get unnecessarily harmed by their care.
Okay. Number one, safety. Number two.
Number two is, we say, effectiveness. That means avoiding overuse and underuse of care. Effectiveness refers to the following. Can we promise patients that they're going to get scientifically correct care, everything that would help them, and not give them care that won't help them? Don't do unnecessary things. We have a recent research study, for example, that shows that in a review of records for 6,000 patients over a two-year period, almost half the time, those patients did not get the care that they should have. And we have, on the reverse side, overuse, evidence that a lot of the tests and drugs and even surgeries that are done are unnecessary, scientifically invalid. They shouldn't be done at all.
But when you say a patient didn't get the care he or she should have received, is this the kind of the old space of one doctor always has a different opinion from another doctor? You understand what I mean?
Absolutely. There are at least two parts to that. First, we don't have a promise that we're going to deliver standard effective care. Doctors do vary a lot in the way they use care, and right now it's very hard to keep up with the scientific literature. I recently read a paper that said that a doctor who read one randomized trial a day for a year would be 10,000 years behind in his or her reading by the end of the year. That's how much information is pouring out. We need to commit to standardizing to the very best care and doing away with some of the senseless variation in care.
I want to just step away from the list for half a minute and talk about your right knee here, if I can, because when I listen to you talking about promises and guarantees from within the medical system, nobody I know ever gets promised anything. Nobody ever gets guaranteed anything. You were, when you were looking for care for your knee, this was something that you were musing about, right?
Yeah, well, we don't have a habit of reliability in the system. This doesn't have to do with the intentions of the doctors and nurses. I believe all the doctors and nurses almost all of them are trying just as hard as they can to do the right thing. But to be reliable in a very complicated system is a really hard job, and we've never promised that. We never said to the American public, we promise that every patient with diabetes will get exactly the correct care for diabetes according to the best science, no matter where they go or when they go. Instead, we kind of roll dice, so it kind of depends on whether the doctor or nurse you see has read the most recent paper or has made a commitment to follow the science.
But who would be the we who would make the promise? Because the patient sees the nurse or the doctor. It's only just that sort of one-on-one encounter, right?
Well, the problem is fragmentation. We have nobody to speak for at that level of leadership now, and we badly need it. We need the professional communities of the country, the leaders of hospitals and medical associations, politicians, I think, and the public to kind of make a decision that we're going to promise scientific care. And we need to train to that. Our medical students and nursing students need to be educated in a system which says it is not unprofessional to standardize your care to the right protocol. It's actually professional to do that.
So you're imagining a situation where the head of a hospital would make his or her own personal guarantee to patients coming in that you're going to get this quality care, and there's my signature to guarantee it.
We're spending $1.5 trillion on healthcare in America, and if that's not enough to allow us to make some promises to patients, at least about what we do, if not about what they do, I don't know what amount of money would be enough.
I am going to get back to your list, but I also want to try and get a better understanding, Don, of why it is my own understanding of the healthcare system is so far away from this notion that you're talking about where I should expect promises and guarantees to be fulfilled. I mean, I'm in my mid-40s. In what way was I raised looking at doctors and nurses and hospitals that makes this whole idea so strange to me?
Well, over a century, we've developed proud professionals who believe deeply in their own good intentions and their competence, and they should, and respectful patients who want to respect and trust the doctors and nurses they see. So we built a culture in which it's maybe feels a little rude to ask about guarantees and promises and a little countercultural for physicians to commit to that kind of reliability. It's a belief system. But we are in a very complicated industry now, and we need to change the way we think.
Sounds like you're talking about perhaps the most dramatic change in the way that doctors deal with their patients.
Yes. I'm not one who blames doctors. I think doctors are trying hard. I want to say again, nothing about what I believe is meant to be disrespectful of the intentions of physicians. But physicians know perhaps first of all how complicated the systems they work in are, and there is going to have to be a change in the mentality and commitments of doctors. I'd like to see us train young people and have them become doctors and nurses who say, I'm going to give up a certain level of personal autonomy to make whatever decision I wish because I have such respect for the scientific world which can give me the rules according to which I ought to give care, just like pilots follow rules when they fly airplanes.
But the autonomy that a doctor would give up, I suspect that doctor would see it in terms of professional integrity rather than autonomy. I'm a doctor, for goodness sakes. I know what's wrong with you and how to fix it.
Well, for the occasional patient, of course, we want every doctor to be thinking very hard about variations in care that they ought to introduce. But that's my point. It is professional integrity to make a promise and to adhere to the best known science reliably. And that means if the doctor across the street from you or in a different state is doing something different from you, you probably can't both be right if it's the same patient.
So what do doctors say when you float that notion to them in a speech at a medical conference? Do you get a few raised eyebrows?
That's changing a lot. Yes, a lot of raised eyebrows. After all, I was trained, as most of my colleagues were, in an era of romance about the individual physician trying to remember everything, trying to be the best they can and using personal effort to be excellent. But there's first a younger cadre of doctors now, perhaps the Generation Y people growing up in the computer age who understand how complex the world is and who really are looking for standards. standards and norms that they can adhere to. And I also think a lot of doctors of any age are frustrated now. They're really to some extent losing affection for the profession they joined, and they need to recover that. And I think they can recover that by commitment to excellence and, I think, commitment to change. They all know that things aren't working well, and we need to say it openly and then get about the job of changing the system.
You're saying that let's focus less on the art of medicine, more on the science of medicine. Is that part of the message to doctors, to patients?
We need the art of medicine badly. When I'm in pain or need a question answered or I'm simply upset, I need someone to hold my hand. I need someone who will be there with me and who will relate to me. That's the art of medicine. But to say that there are 1,000 different great ways to treat diabetes is just plain wrong. There aren't. There are a few scientifically grounded ways to treat diabetes, and that's what we need to promise. We shouldn't confuse a commitment to science and standardization with giving up the art of medicine. In fact, it's just the opposite. Because if we could standardize care to the very best science, we'd have more time and energy and attention on the part of doctors and nurses to do exactly what they need to do with their hearts and their souls to take care of patients and relieve their emotional and spiritual pain.
We are talking about number three on your list here when we're talking about the level of care and the contract between doctors and patients, are we not?
Number three on the list is patient-centeredness,
okay.
And that's the Institute of Medicine's term for it. I'm pretty radical on this. I think the only way to get to what we need is to put patients in control. We need to turn the keys to the car back over to the patients. In healthcare, we have a habit, traditions even, of making people helpless. I don't know how we got there, but we put them in ridiculous hospital gowns and we talk at them. The average time that a doctor remains silent when they begin to talk to a patient in measured experiments is 17 seconds. That's not long enough to listen. And I'm one now for shifting the power balance. I think if patients really were in control, if they owned their own medical records and carried them with them, if they could get to their doctors on email, if they could chat with each other as well as with the doctors, we'd have a much healthier system and I think a lot less expensive system because people are really smart about their own care and they know a lot about their illnesses and we need to harness that knowledge.
I mean, I actually like my doctor a lot. I don't mean to criticize her when I say it's hard to get an appointment with her. I always figure that's just because she's busy fixing a bunch of other people who are probably sicker than I am. But if you give the keys to the patient, then I can imagine a circumstance where I'm never going to see my doctor because anybody who wants to, who's a patient of my doctor, gets to call up and say, I'm going to be in an hour and I want you to see me, and the system would collapse from the other direction, would it not?
Well, that's a widespread fear, but I think it's a bit of a myth. There are some patients, of course, whose demands would be very large and maybe even excessive if they really were in control of their own care. But the experience goes the other way. The more patients are in control of their own care, the more they understand about their illnesses, the more they know about their own medical records, the more they understand about their drugs, the more of the burden they take and want to take. If you can reach your doctor by email, you don't have to come in and visit your doctor. If you can read your medical record, you might get an answer to a question that you'd otherwise have to call for. You might also find a mistake. Also, a lot of the delays are introduced because there are defects in the system. The doctors know what I'm talking about. They're running around looking for the missing lab test or trying to track down a consultant that hasn't reached them. It's a tough job. We can make it easier.
1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, your sense of what's broken and how to fix it, and perhaps some prescriptions from you based on your own experiences with the healthcare system. 1-800-423-TALK to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Don Berwick is with me in the studio. He has a new book out called Escape Fire, Designs for the Future of Healthcare. And the word fire is not there by accident in the title of the book. If he had his druthers, he would set fire to the U.S. healthcare system and look at rebuilding it from the ground up. We're taking your calls this hour about what problems you see within the system. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Don, your father was I don't know if I should call him a country doctor, but he was a doctor of the old school, right?
He was a country doctor, a GP in a small town in Connecticut, yeah.
What would he think of your ideas of putting the patient in charge?
I think you might first say, wait a minute, I'm in charge. My father was a doctor of the old school, and we were all trained. You know, we'll take charge. The patient, to some extent, remains silent, and we give the right treatment. And that was maybe right for that era. I don't think he had to experience the the emergence of the consumer society, the internet and availability of information, and people's growing expectations for how they're going to be treated as customers. I'm sure he would have adapted, but it would have taken some time.
There's just one element of that time that you are saying is salvageable, and that is that sense of care when the doctor would actually sit on the side of your bed and talk to you. I mean, for those of us who are nostalgic about the man with the black bag who parked his car in front of your house, I mean, that it's kind of nice to hold on to that.
We should never give that up. That's the goal. That's the platinum of healthcare. We need doctors and nurses and other and pharmacists and others to be able to sit with the patient, hold the hand, and speak gently and exchange words. We're taking the time away now, Dick, with the defects in care. We're making people run uphill all the time, and they don't have time to do what really matters at that level that only a human being can deliver.
Back to your checklist, timeliness. What are you talking about when you talk about timeliness?
That's the fourth defect. Delay is everywhere in healthcare. Everybody waits. You wait for your appointment. You wait to see the specialist. You wait in the doctor's office. And by the way, all the doctors and nurses are waiting around, too, for the operation to start on time or for the information to come. We have a system full of delays that will be unacceptable in any other industry. And that's because we never built it right. We never built for flow. For continuous flow across boundaries.
Now, one of the things that you've done over the last 15 years is actually explore other industries that address these questions of flow. Was there one that you thought had a model which could adapt to a hospital? We're not talking about putting television sets in boxes here where everything moves along a conveyor belt.
No, we're not, although we can learn from industries that have to manage that way. I've learned a lot from Toyota and heavy automobile manufacturing, which has managed flow to an absolute art form with a method called lean thinking or lean production, where we try to establish flow through a very complex production system. We learned a lot from a visit to a hotel chain. We watched the food services department in a hotel orchestrate the flow of food for room service from a relatively high level. They had a flow manager. They had someone actually aware of where all the trays were at any particular time. We don't have anybody in a hospital who knows where all the patients are at any particular time. And if we got more serious about that kind of systematic, scientifically grounded management of flow, which would require people to give up something, people have to agree to be part of that system, man, the weights would fall lower than anyone today thinks possible.
On with the list. Efficiency? Is that what we're looking
Efficiency
at?
Is the word the Institute of Medicine uses for what I call waste, pure waste. We have, as I said, about 30 or 40% more dollars going into healthcare in our country than any other country in the Western world. And there are many systems that perform better than ours do. We are wasting lots of money. Time, money, equipment, space, people. Nurses spend half their time creating records nowadays. It's just nonsense. Those records aren't often used by anyone at all. They're a result of fossilized recording habits. We have a very interesting study out from Professor Elliot Fisher at Dartmouth this year, which is, I think, a blockbuster. Fisher went around the United States with data and divided the areas of our country into quintiles, fifth, with respect to how much money they're spending on health care. So there's the lowest fifth, the next fifth, up to the top fifth. And then he asked the question, does the amount of money you're spending on health care predict the quality of care? And he had a bunch of measures of quality. Well, guess what? It does predict the quality of care in reverse. The more money is being spent, the lower the quality of care. At least at the very top level of expenditure in this country, those are the areas with the lowest quality of care, the lowest reliability. Our system's incredibly wasteful.
Let me ask you a question. I cut my head a few weeks back and went to the hospital. And in the course of being looked at by the person who saw me when I came in and the person who then looked at me and someone else who looked at me and then someone else who looked at me and the person who finally came and did something about it, I think that the hospital went through 8 or 9 pairs of disposable gloves as all these various people came to look at this little cut on the top of my head. And I was thinking of that in preparation for seeing you and thinking, is that what you mean by waste, or is that kind of like just an indicator of a bigger problem?
It's an indicator. It's certainly a form of waste. We waste supplies and equipment. Machines lie idle. We just way overuse equipment and space in our system. We waste it. But there are more subtle forms of waste. Wasting time by not having proper flow in a system is a form of waste. Oversupplying care is a form of waste. We have a study in Colorado that shows that children with ear infections, which are very simple to treat, 30% of the time got extremely advanced, excessive antibiotics that would basically elephant gun antibiotics that they absolutely didn't need. And that's pure waste. And then the waste that also concerns me is waste of spirit. we have a healthcare workforce with tremendous ideas, lots of energy. And I think now we're in a system which often doesn't let people speak up and use their ideas.
Yeah, a lot of these people are burned out, too.
Absolutely. Nursing is in a real crisis. I think it may be the major problem in American medicine today in some ways is to restore joy to the nursing profession. It's a battered, beleaguered profession right now, and we need to change that.
I want to finish the checklist, and then we're going to bring some of our callers in. What's the last on
the sixth
list?
Item is equity. Probably should be the first one. I sometimes challenge my medical students with the following question. If you could do one test on an American randomly selected that'll predict their lifespan and their health status, one test, I'll just give you one, what would it be? The answer is absolutely clear. It's look at the color of their skin. A black child born in inner city Baltimore or Washington this year will have a life expectancy 7 years shorter than a white one. There's no predictor of health status in our country stronger than race, none at all. And we have to stop that. That's the biggest quality problem in America in some extent. And we need a strong political and public policy commitment to closing that gap once and for all. It's unjustifiable, and it is a quality problem.
Do these issues or these ideas of yours also promise an end to the 40 or 50 million people, excuse me, who have no medical insurance in the country?
Absolutely, yes. All that waste, all that resource that we're pouring down the drain could be put to use in supplying coverage to people that don't have it today. But let the people with coverage be under no illusion. They are in a defective system even if they do have coverage. Both are very, very serious problems. We need universal health care coverage in this country as a matter of ethics, justice, and efficiency.
And you can do it within a private system. You're not talking about going to a British or public health care system, or are you?
I'm not so sure. I don't know exactly what systems are compatible with that kind of universality, but one way or another, this country has got to make a commitment from the top and with the public that you can't be an American and not have health care coverage.
It's interesting because the debate so often goes straight to public, private, universal, or otherwise, and you're looking at all those pieces that underlie the healthcare system.
Well, it is the case that we're the only Western democracy that doesn't guarantee care to its citizens, and all the ones that successfully do have some form of a government safety net, which absolutely guarantees that if no one else will insure a citizen, they will.
Connection listeners, you have heard the list. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Time to go to the front of the line now. Raleigh, North Carolina. Brian's been waiting on the phone. Brian, thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to understand how giving the keys to patients is going to address any of these problems. I have two examples I'd like to quote, both from relatives, both who suffered cancer. The first example involved a skin cancer which required a removal, left a big hole in the leg. And while the person in question complained constantly to her family of the discomfort of, she wasn't sure what was being done was correct, whether the discomfort she was experiencing was appropriate and so on, but she would never go to the doctor to ask that. The second example is another relative whose bowel cancer resulted in a colostomy. From the point that she was told that she had a cancer, she just switched off. She wanted to know nothing about what the treatment was going to be, the consequences of the treatment. She just wanted it dealt with, and she completely closed her mind to it. I'll take your response on the radio.
Brian, just before you go, what you're saying, if I understand you correctly, is that patients aren't ready to take the keys to the car.
Absolutely. It's like giving me a key to a semi and a big rig. I'd know where to put the key, but beyond that, I wouldn't know what to do. The people I'm referring to, I believe there's a very large proportion of the population, particularly those people who are now 60-plus,
right,
simply wouldn't have a clue.
All right, Brian, don't hang up, because if Don has any questions, it'd be nice to keep you here.
Well, Brian, I understand what you're asking. First, we've trained people for helplessness. We have a century of educating patients that they cannot take charge, and it's not a switch we can just throw. We have to commit to educational patterns and involvement of patients in ways that allow them to take the amount of control they want. Second, I don't urge that every single patient be told they must take over their own care. I want to create the opportunity for those who wish to become more involved. If the patients you cited want to turn the keys back over to the doctor, that's their right to do too. It's a matter of customizing the degree of patient control to the patient. But we've done it all the other way. We've said because some patients can't take control, because some don't understand, then no one can get access to the information they need. Try to get your own medical record. You're going to find it's really difficult, even if you full well could understand it. Try to ask the doctor if you can begin to adjust your own medications according to rules the doctor teaches you and see how often the answer is yes to that. So we need to customize care to the patient and give people the absolute highest level of opportunity to take over the care they want to take over.
Okay, I think I understand what you're saying, but we have one way of doing things today. You are introducing something at the other end of the spectrum almost, whereby, you know, I as an individual would be able to go to my doctor and say, I have a problem, what tests have to be done, fine, I will monitor the tests, so on and so forth. In between those, what may be viewed as extremes, you've got quite a wide spectrum, which is going to involve more money, more very differentiated training. All I can see is complexity there.
It will be simplification, not complexity, Brian, because now we're taking the keys from everybody and not letting people do for themselves what they can. We have tremendous evidence that with some instruction, diabetics, hypertensives, asthmatics, people with chronic illness can become, to a large extent, their own caretakers, and they like it better. They make better judgments. And I'm not saying they divorce themselves from their clinical systems. They begin to become partners, and that system's cheaper, not more expensive.
Now, you're on the road all the time, Don. You're talking about this to healthcare professionals. Are there hospitals in the United States that have said, hey, it's a good idea. We're going to try a system where the patient is boss, the doctor is the visitor or the guest in that person's life?
Not totally, but the lights are starting to turn on. I see many hospitals and clinical systems around the country that are doing thrilling things to help involve people more in their own care, to share decisions with them, and to train them to do better for themselves.
Brian, thanks for that call. Next to Ipswich, Massachusetts, and Johanna, you're with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm a retired dentist, and I attended medical school in the 80s. And two things became immediately clear to me when I was in school. One was that the curriculum was way too focused on high-tech interventions and pharmaceuticals, and that the patient had, in fact, abdicated responsibility for their own health. And we're living under this misconception that we can just not take responsibility for our health until we get into a crisis situation, and then some magic pill or machine is going to fix us.
Now, Johanna, you're saying that you would, in fact, as a patient, if you present yourself as a patient instead of a dentist, say you would like to have a little bit more control, right?
Well, I do in my own life, yes. I don't go to doctors unless I absolutely have to.
So I don't have your training. I never went to medical school. Do you think that I can do it?
It doesn't require that. 100 years ago, everybody had their own homeopathic kits and first aid kits at home, and it made sense that the doctor came to your home to help you. We also have a problem of colliding entitlements where doctors are trained for some of them 10 years after college, 12 years. They're trained in how to treat people with drugs and high-tech interventions, and they're not able to train patients to go back home and go to the basics. From the very beginning, when they're born, the mother has to take care of the child, and the system wouldn't be so crowded if people weren't coming in for all these little things that they should have been taking care of at home.
Does it, Don, mean a de-emphasis in the reliance that we have come to on pharmaceuticals and the sort of high-tech treatments that Johanna's talking about?
Well, we have miraculous new technologies and drugs that we must not give up. But on the whole, yes, we're over-invested in technology as an answer. We somehow have produced the illusion there is a machine out there that will somehow save you, our technology is way beyond other countries which have health status and outcomes just as good as ours. But I only take some exception to Joanna's framing, I believe, because I don't think the patients have abdicated responsibility. I think we taught them to give up responsibility by taking so much control over their care. I differ with some of the critics of the system in that I don't blame patients at all. I don't think people are unreasonable when they're patients. I don't think they want to abdicate responsibility. I think they need some help to know how to take responsibility, and I deeply believe that they want to. But you can't do that on the other side of a machine. You have to be facing the person face-to-face and do away with the illusion that more is better. If the public could somehow learn that in healthcare, more is not better, more is frequently worse care, then we could begin to reset the thermostat at the right temperature and get more oriented to these issues that Johanna's addressing.
And what's your general attitude toward drugs? Are we too inclined to treat ailments with drugs today?
It's a complex issue. I think there have been tremendous progress in drugs. We have an armamentarium of drugs now that wasn't present when I trained, and I didn't train that long ago. But we confuse real enhancements in effective pharmaceuticals with bells and whistles and small changes in drugs that really add no value at all. And often we overuse very intense drugs when simpler ones would do. So we have to kind of pare away where drugs really add value, new ones do, and where we're just simply infatuated with novelty to our own disadvantage.
But all we get right now is the two ends of the spectrum where a drug company's television advertisement is extolling all the virtues of what they think we should take, even if we don't know we should take it, and then the doctor saying whatever he or she thinks about the drug. And still, we're not left with the kind of information that might be useful to us as patients.
That's right. Now, we have this direct-to-consumer advertising you're talking about, and drug companies are now spending as much as that as they are on that as they are in professional advertising. I'm actually not sure that's a bad thing. I think transparency is the issue here. We need to open up the gates of information, and that's one way. But if all we do is flood people with information about novelty and suggest it's good, we're not completing the job of education. So we need as much investment in helping people understand what they don't need. And we need a very skeptical public. We need your listeners to be asking the question all the time, are they really sure? Will this really help me? Maybe more isn't better here. Maybe simpler is better.
Well, but you're expecting people to draw from advertising copy what the truth is, and that's hard to do.
Absolutely, yes. Where will the source of the reliable knowledge other than that come from? And we need a public investment in helping people understand the difference between good care and bad care.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. That's the number to join my conversation this hour with Don Berwick. He is President, Chief Executive Officer of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. It's a nonprofit organization with the mission of improving healthcare worldwide. He's also a clinical professor of pediatrics and healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School. He's got a new book out. It's called Escape Fire, Designs for the Future of Healthcare. 1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. When we talk about the healthcare system, we're almost always talking about curing what ails us. Don Berwick wants us to think a little bit about what's ailing the healthcare system and where it's not serving us properly. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. To Boston, Massachusetts now, and Eric's joining us on the phone. Eric, thanks for calling.
No problem. Thank you. Thank you, Dick, for taking my call. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you again. Dr. Berwick, I'm calling from Harvard Medical School's Division of Medical Ethics. And as you know, we're hosting a two-day symposium this April on professional values in the age of consumer medicine. It's a shame that your schedule couldn't allow your participation in the conference. I would like to ask you one of the questions I was going to ask you this April, which is a question that points to your items of professional integrity and quality of care. My question is, how should physicians in our healthcare system respond to patient demands for unnecessary or inappropriate demands? Your mention of childhood ear infections, I think, is just really illustrative. We know that many ear infections would resolve themselves within 48 hours without antibiotics, yet most parents, when they bring their child to the pediatrician's office, expect a prescription.
So, Eric, is it an ethical question or is it a medical question? How does a doctor deal with the parents or how does the parent...
It's an ethical question, but it also is a question that speaks to Dr. Berwick's notion of switching our healthcare system such that the patient is in control, the patient is driving it. And I'm wondering, should the patients be driving it if they're bombarded with direct-to-consumer advertisements?
Well, Eric, first, I have a lot of trust in the wisdom and intelligence of patients. I think there's a kind of myth that if we open the doors to their ability to ask us for what they want and need, they'll be unreasonable and excessive in what they ask for. We can all tell stories when that can happen, but on the whole, I don't think that's going to happen. I think people want knowledge, and they want parsimony in their care. With respect to the particular issue of prescribing, we have a great paper that appeared in the pediatrics literature last year, as you probably know, exploring an innovation, safety net prescribing. You say to the patient, well, I don't think you need the antibiotic for this ear infection, but I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll write the prescription. You put it in your pocket and wait 2 days. Just don't fill it yet. Let's do an experiment with me. And if your child isn't better in 2 days, well, go ahead and fill it. And that's been shown to reduce dramatically the filling of prescriptions because these intelligent patients, or in this case, parents, are watching carefully and trying to learn with us. There are solutions. There's daylight here. And I think saying patients don't know how to take control is just plain not right.
I can imagine a sort of initial sense of horror on the part of the parent going, I'm going to make this decision. I want the doctor to make this decision. Does my daughter need the drugs now or not?
I would say if you're confused, why don't you email me day after tomorrow and we'll have a little bit of a chat about it. You can be there with the patient and still help them become more and more sophisticated in how they make the decisions they want to make.
All right, Eric, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255, Medford, Massachusetts. And Barbara, you're with us. Go ahead.
Yes. Hello, Dr. Buick. I read your article in the Boston Sunday Globe, and I'm very interested to give you my comment. My comment is, how can the patient and the patient's family take control? My husband was recently hospitalized in a well-known hospital. He had an allergic reaction to the medication he was taking, but the doctor insisted he keep taking it. It said this is the only thing that's alleviating his other symptoms. He refused to acknowledge that this fever was going to lead to other things. He was sent to the emergency room once and came back to the hospital he was already in, and they kept giving it to him, only to return to the trauma unit in the ER, where he was extremely ill, near death, and
How did it end, Barbara?
It ended that the second time around, they did stop the medicine. But the point is that from the very beginning, the PDR was saying that this particular medicine should not be combined. And this particular medicine was not for the diagnosis that my husband had. And I tried to talk to the doctor about my concerns about a fever in the body indicating a bad omen, and the doctor refused to listen, and he hung up. Meanwhile, two visits later, my husband was nearly dead in the ER.
This is an experience not unlike one that you've had as well, when your wife was in getting care.
The
complication.
Doctor.
Hang on a second, Barbara. Let's hear from Don for a minute here.
Well, Barbara, first, I'm so sorry to hear your story. I hope your husband's okay. And it's the kind of problem I think we really need to work hard to get out of the system. We got to look at it from the doctor's point of view first. I don't know why your doctor couldn't listen better. Maybe he or she was too busy or had distractions or was themselves under stress. Or maybe they were never trained to do that. We've got some upstream work here to do to train people to be more receptive. On your end, we need to open the doors more to let you be more vocal and more involved in your care. I think transparency, involvement in care is absolutely key. That's why I want all patients to have their medical records. I think that would be a massive and important change in our system. If you simply had your record to read and look at, you could pick things up, maybe be invited to contribute to it. When it works brilliantly. I've been advocating in the past year for opening the doors of intensive care units. Why would a family, have to wait outside the ICU to visit your husband as if you were a 10-year-old asking to go to the bathroom or something? We need to open the intensive care units and the hospital wards to visitors.
You mean no more visiting hours?
Absolutely no more visiting hours. I don't know where we ever got the idea that we could limit visiting hours. Where do we ever get the right to do that, to keep Barbara from her husband? She has a right to tell us not to be there, but not the other way around. Places that have taken this challenge, I'm thinking, for example, of Geisinger Clinic in Pennsylvania, heard that challenge, took it, opened their ICU, and everything gets better. Everything gets better. The doctors and nurses, after they got over the initial fear, are now reporting better communication. They're sharing more information. Maybe there, Barbara would have been able to offer some information. They've been inviting patients to go on rounds with them and to contribute information. Barbara would have had a voice there. There's a deep link between safety and opening the doors, transparency, and this kind of involvement that Barbara's asking for.
All right, Barbara, thanks for your call. I want to move on here. We have a number of people on the line. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Wayland, Massachusetts. Susan, you're with us. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah. It's similar to what the previous caller was speaking about, patients how do you speak to a doctor who doesn't want to listen? Unfortunately, this has been my experience, and I'd like to know how a patient can engage a doctor with questions and instead of alienating them.
What did your doctor say, Susan?
I've had a series of doctors.
Give me one good example.
One good example, most benign was, gee, pain is an awful thing. Don't let it get you depressed. And then one of the more extreme was, I'm looking at a spine here on a bone scan, four lower rupture discs, one upper rupture disc, perfectly fine spine to me. Do you have a therapist? Why don't you get one and up those antidepressants? My husband was with me at the time we walked out of the office. And the most recent was simply, you know, your back is a mess. I don't know what to tell you. Why don't you see a primary care or repeat this procedure that you said you had twice, but I don't really think you had it, so let's try it again.
So where are you now? Are you seeing a doctor?
Actually, I've reached desperation's edge. I've let go of the rope, and I am seeing, thanks to a good friend who managed to have connections, I am finally getting in to see someone Thursday who originally couldn't have seen me at all and then was willing to look at my tests and then said, yes, we'll bump you up from April to January. I find it extremely frustrating, and I'm going in to see this person who actually, when my neighbor spoke with him, because I said I'm phobic about seeing a doctor, he spoke with him and said, actually, most adult back pain patients who've been through surgery are frequently misdiagnosed, are frequently mistreated, and go through hell to finally get relief. So
let me just stop you there for half a second, if I can, Susan.
Sure.
I want to bring Dawn into the conversation, because I know when you're talking about pain. Back pain's a great example, but just pain itself. I mean, this is something where your business becomes so subjective, and some of your suggestions here, how do they work?
Well, this is a good case where science matters. We understand pain control far better now than we ever did before. The science of pain control has advanced greatly. And the first question I have about Susan Care is, have we made the promise to Susan that the best possible care will be brought to bear on her? Is that the standard? The answer is no here. She's experiencing the variation from place to place and doctor to doctor that plagues us. It will take some generosity and respectfulness on Susan's part to forgive her doctor, to understand that this is a person probably trying very hard to do well, but who's under some form of stress or not trained to listen as carefully or to use the science reliably. But I believe Susan deserves a guarantee that she's, no matter what door she walks in, she's going to get the same standard, excellent, scientifically grounded pain control.
But when you say guarantee in the way that you phrase it, Don, I'm thinking like a warranty or something, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking, oh, God, this is just going to become something, some other reason to take a doctor to a courtroom
because
the guarantee wasn't lived up to. Do you know what I mean?
No, I hope not. I think the litigation system, if we want to get into that, is a real mess.
Let's not go there. It's a subject of another show. But, isn't that a risk when you're making promises and guarantees that you're setting standards by which you'll be measured and perhaps even measured in a litigious way?
Well, I'm thinking first more about a more human-to-human interaction here. First, it starts with leaders. The doctor that Susan saw is in some kind of leadership system. The leaders of that system, the boards of trustees of the hospital, the heads of those practices need to understand the nature of making a promise, what that means. It means they're going to have to build a cocoon around that doctor, a safe place for that doctor to do work so that the doctor can deliver on the guarantee. This is a leadership issue. Beyond that, there's a transparency issue here. Notice that Susan cannot do one thing that she ought to be able to do. If she doesn't believe that this particular group of doctors is listening, she needs to be able to find out who does listen. And that's a matter of publicness about performance. And if we had more of a commitment to measurement of performance, if we knew what patients were saying about the characteristics of various systems, Susan could find a system, undoubtedly, a doctor in this community that would meet her needs exactly as she wishes them to be met.
Part of what, when I'm listening to you talk, part of me is thinking, you know, for all those broken toes and earaches and bumps and scrapes and tummy upsets, why aren't we there right now? But I'm going back to what we heard at the beginning of the program when we're talking about cancers and more drastic diseases. I'm sure there are people out there saying, no, it's just like your idea of putting the patient in charge of his or her cancer is something that people would balk at.
If it were expressed as an extreme, a cartoon, yes, they would balk at it and they should balk at it. But I'm talking about involvement. I'm talking about we have a choice between medical treatment or surgical treatment? We can take this risky procedure or not. Can we talk about it? What does your values say? What do your preferences say? How does this feel to you? I'm going to give you this drug. You're going to be the best person to know what the drug's doing for you. Report back to me. Let's talk about your experience. I'm talking about mobilizing the patient and the patient's knowledge and the family as a real genuine resource in the system and not making it passive or infantilizing it the way we customarily do. And that goes as much for people who are very sick as for people with minor illnesses.
You're talking, Don, about changing leadership. You're a professor, so you're teaching the kids who are studying medicine right now. What's the real starting point of turning this around? If, in fact, you're blowing up a system in order to rebuild it from the ground up, I get the part that you need the leaders on side and you need the students buying in. But what's the real starting point here? Is it with the medical system, the healthcare delivery system, or is it with me? Is it with patients?
Well, it's with both. The starting place, I'm not sure, but I think it has to be honesty. It has to be the courage to say out loud that the system doesn't do what we need it to do. Until we admit that it's failing us, we're not going to change it. And there's too much politically correct rhetoric around that we have the greatest health system in the world and it functions just fine and everything's okay and patients are too demanding. We need to admit that there are defects. I'm seeing some courage here. There's a wonderful thing going on in Wisconsin. Theta Care, Bellin Hospital, Geisinger Clinic, they've combined, Gunderson Lutheran Clinic in Wisconsin, they've combined to publicly report their performance. No one asked them to do it. They're measuring what they're doing, and they're putting out a report in central Wisconsin about what they're accomplishing. And I think that's courageous. They're saying, wait a minute, this isn't good enough.
So you're getting hospitals to say, here's what we're doing to make sure there aren't infections that have been plaguing patients, that there aren't the medical accidents.
Absolutely. They're small numbers, but they're very exciting to work with. They're honest about the defects. And then the second thing is they understand that they can't get better performance out of the current system. They're going to have to change. There's a great little hospital out in Santa Cruz, California, Dominican Santa Cruz. I just saw their data this year. Zero respirator infections. They've done away with ventilator pneumonia. When you're on a respirator in an intensive care unit, you're set up for infection. They've stopped it. So has Baptist DeSoto in Memphis, Tennessee. These hospitals have come out of nowhere, so to speak, and they've changed the way they're giving care. They've committed to standardization, to excellence. They've decided their defects they're going to remove. Their leaders are behind them. It's very exciting when that happens.
So you're more encouraged than discouraged?
Oh, I'm getting there.
Thank you so much for coming in to spend an hour with us.
You're welcome.
Don Berwick is a professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and president, chief executive officer of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. It's a nonprofit organization with the mission of improving healthcare. He's author of a brand new book. It's called Escape Fire, Designs for the Future of Healthcare. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.